Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. On June 1st, 1981, two young activists, Silme Domingo and Jean Vernes, were murdered in Seattle in what was made to appear like a gang slaying. But the victims' families and friends suspected they were considered a threat to the dictatorship of Philippines dictator Ferdinand Marcos and his regime's relationship to the United States. But how could they prove it up against such powerful and ruthless adversaries? In summary execution, attorney and author Michael Withy describes his 10-year battle for justice for Domingo and Vernes, that he fought because they killed my friends. Follow along as he embarks on a long and dangerous investigation and into the courtroom to obtain convictions of three hitmen and then prove in U.S. federal court that Marcos was behind the assassinations. If so, it would be the first time in U.S. history that a foreign head of state would be held liable for the murder of American citizens on U.S. soil. However, to accomplish this, Withy and his legal team, working with the victims' families and friends, would have to defeat concerted efforts by the murderers and those who hired them to cover up their crimes and obstruct justice. Then they'd have to overcome numerous obstacles, including exposing the perjured eyewitness testimony of an FBI informant, uncovering the brutal murder of an accomplice who was being sought to turn state's evidence, and working around the failure by local authorities to prosecute the Marcos operative who planned the murders. The book that we're featuring this evening is Summary Execution, The Seattle Assassinations of Silme Domingo and Jean Vernes, by my special guest, attorney and author Michael Withy. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Michael Withy.
Well, thanks so much for having me, Dan. I'm looking forward to your questions and talking about this case and this book.
Absolutely fascinating. I normally would ask your background, how you came to come to this, but I think very, very quickly we will find out your incredible involvement in this case, in this story. So let's start off as you do in this book, June 1st, 1981, just to set the stage here. You have a local 37 Union Hall in Seattle, and you have the president, Tony Barroso, his real name is Constantine, and you open with a photo in his office of him shaking hands with Ferdinand Marcos. So then you introduce the Secretary-Treasurer, Silme Domingo, Batcher Jean Vernes. So tell us what they were recently elected as, and tell us a little bit about the union that they work in and represent, and a little bit about, you mentioned that they don't share Barroso's politics, so tell us a little bit about, as you do in the beginning, and set the stage for this incredible day where they're about to meet fellow activist David Della.
Sure, Dan. Yeah, Gene and Selmy were leaders of the reform movement within Local 37. It's a cannery workers local, largely Filipino workforce that dispatches about 1,400 cannery workers out of Seattle to basically work the slime lines up in Alaska at the canneries. They're very popular. They had been doing union organizing for years, and they had also brought race discrimination suits against the Alaska seafood industry. And they had decided that they wanted to reform the dispatch out of Local 37 from one which is basically kind of based on bribes you have to pay to Tony Barroso or to the foreman And just not fair to cannery workers who had worked the previous years. So Gene and Selmy and I came up with a reform dispatch that based it on the Constitution. Well, both Gene and Selmy were aware that there were forces within the union that, you know, weren't going to be happy with this dispatch. But on the other hand, and there had been a very kind of scary encounter with Tony Dictato, who was the head of the local Tulasan gang. That was a Filipino gang in the International District. And Tony Dictato had wanted some of his boys to be dispatched up to the Dillingham Cannery at Peter Pan in Alaska that weren't dispatched under the new dispatch. So there was some, you know, angry words exchanged. In the meantime, both Gene and Selmy, who had just recently been elected to the union, were seen as kind of a distant threat to Tony Barroso, who was the union president, but also a very strong pro-Marcos ally. And so Gene and Selmy had been very active in anti-Marcos politics, both in the United States and internationally. And I can go into more detail what Gene and Selmy had done, which threatened the relationship between Ferdinand Marcos and the labor movement in the Philippines and the opposition in the countryside. But needless to say, they were there on June 1st in the context and a vortex of union reform, Tony Barroso not happy with them, and then their anti-Marcos politics, all of which came into play when the bullets start flying in that union hall.
Now, you also talk about them being this partners in this movement. So why don't you just go back, as you do quickly, to a little bit about the backgrounds of Silmé Domingo,
sure,
as opposed to his partner. They make great partners, but they're very, very different people. And so tell us a little bit about Silmé Domingo first. You talk about his father being the former vice president of Local 37, so this is in his blood. So tell us a little bit about Silmé Domingo.
Well, Selmy, when he first went to the cannery, saw his father's name etched in a, you know, kind of carved out, Nemesio Domingo Sr., and just realized the importance that this work held for Filipinos coming to the United States, because his father's initials were engraved in the cannery back in the, you know, back in the 1950s. But more importantly, you know, Selmy was a strategist. He was one of the leaders of the Union of Democratic Filipinos, a national anti-Marcos pro-socialist organization in the U.S. He was the kind of the mastermind, the strategist. He was a great union organizer. He knew how to talk, cannery workers into joining the union in an unbelievably great way. And, you know, he was a very formidable opponent. He was my best friend. And Selmy, you know, loaned me his car if my family came to town. We shared a lot. And he was just an amazing, amazing, dynamic guy.
Tell us a little bit about Gene Vernis and
sure,
the differences between the two.
Well, Gene was the salt of the earth. He came from, his dad was Filipino, and his mom was Caucasian, and he grew up with 11 brothers and sisters out in Wapato, Washington, where there was seasonal work in farm working, but also cannery work, which is what Gene really took to. You know, he's always in his overalls, and he would come to the International District to help, help with a community garden, for instance. And Gene would be out there in his wheelbarrowing around, doing all the work, and Selmy in his pump elevator shoes would be standing on the rock looking like $1 million, kind of directing people. So, you know, Bob Santos, the unofficial mayor of the International District, kind of had that description of him. Selmy the strategist, but Gene got the work done. And they were totally inseparable. They were each other's best friends. I just think that, it was always Gene and Selmy, you know. It wasn't Selmy did this or Gene did that. It was Gene and Selmy. And unfortunately, they died together, but they lived an amazing life. You know, Gene worked at the canneries, and when I went up there to do organizing, you know, when Selmy walked in, everybody would stop working, and we'd all come up to it, and there would be Gene with his decibel reader to say, hey, this exceeds the decibel levels. We gotta, you know, we gotta get a hold of OSHA and stuff. He was just an unbelievably dedicated leader.
Now you talk about Ben Galloy and Jimmy Rammel, and if I'm mispronouncing those names, please correct me. And you explain that they're members of this aforementioned gang, the Tulisan gang, which is a Filipino gang. Tell us what this Tulisan gang really specializes in, and tell us a little bit more about Ben Galloy and Jimmy Rammel.
Yeah, Tony Dictato was the head of the gang, and basically they ran gambling operations in the International District at the 509 and 602 Club. These are two clubs that were run there. They were involved with, they were suspected of being involved in murders of prior cannery worker dispatchers. Ramil had been to the canneries, but was kicked out because he was a tough. He had eyes of cold steel. Terry Mass, the widow of Selmy Domingo and a cannery worker herself, recalls that Selmy said the guy is just a cold-blooded murderer. Ben Galloy, on the other hand, was kind of a novice in the gang. I think he was sent as a kind of a decoy because he had been close to Selmy. Selmy had loaned him money in his youth, and he was recently kind of being recruited into the Tulisan gang. So if you want me to describe the murders and how they happened, I'd be happy to. But it was Ramil was selected by Dictato to be the gunman, and Galloy was the decoy. And then there was another Tulisan gang member named Boy Pilay, short for Teodoricos Dominguez. And he was the lookout and also a decoy. And I'll describe how the murders happened, you know, when you want me to.
Before you describe this June 1st murder, the assassinations as you describe them, and now we've set up who the perpetrators are, Galloy and Rammel. So, and this is a Tulisan gang. And, of course, we will talk about the incredible motive and what it looks like rather than what it really is. You have alluded to that this is your friends and you've been involved, but in a few pages you talk about and explain that you were just about to address a large May Day demonstration and militant march of 10,000 people on the streets of Seattle protesting Ronald Reagan's administration's welfare cutbacks and their ongoing union bashing. Now, and as you explained, you were a private attorney with a small solo practice. You helped fund the Seattle Law Collective with then your then brother-in-law, Dan Smith. And together you represented protesters, union members, and minorities in a series of controversial cases. And you moved back to Seattle, spending about a year in Puerto Rico fighting for the independence movement there. So now tell us just a little bit more about the KDP and the Union of Democratic Filipinos and your relationship in that organization, and again, why these people were your friends, but much more, your comrades.
Right. Well, first of all, I was part of the leadership of that large march that took on Reaganomics and the new Reagan administration, but that was as part of a movement in Seattle called No Separate Peace that Gene and Selmy were also leaders of. And right. What was unique about the Seattle politics was the fact that, I went to Beacon Hill School when we occupied it to create El Centro de la Raza. Well, Gene and Selmy were there. If we went down to the picket lines surrounding a construction site, there were no people of color that were building the buildings. People would occupy those spaces, and the African-American construction crews were there. So everybody worked with one another, and the Union of Democratic Filipinos was a leading organization in the entire United States, formed after martial law was declared in the Philippines in 1972. Very dynamic leadership, very effective. They helped establish the coalition against the Marcos dictatorship. They were seen as kind of the leftist, more revolutionary elements within the anti-Marcos opposition. They sought the overthrow of the Marcos regime. There's also moderate politicians like Senator Benigno Aquino who wanted to pursue the electoral path of going back to the Philippines when democracy eventually was brought back. But Gene and Selmy were labor leaders within the Union of Democratic Filipinos. The KDP wasn't a union itself, it was a political organization, but they also had members in various unions. Well, the International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union was a very important union on the West Coast. They loaded and unloaded all the commodities that went to and from the Philippines and Hawaii and the U.S. So to be officers within the ILWU Local 37 gave Gene and Selmy a lot of cachet and the ability then to go to the Philippines and meet with organizations there that were all opposed to Marcos.
Right.
So that's some of the background that comes together here. Dave Della was also a member of the Union of Democratic Filipinos. He was late for the meeting that afternoon because if he had been on time, he probably would have been assassinated as well.
Let's talk about you mentioned that they're supposed to meet Dave Della there at the Local 37 Union Hall. What was it the meeting was about? Was it anything untypical?
It was about the
Sorry? Yes, you were just
no, I'm
about
not
to
muted.
Describe Yes, you were just about to describe the murder on June 1st, Local 37. David Della is late for the meeting. What is the meeting about specifically, and is it typical? What's different about this meeting?
Well, it was typical. It was about some of their work in the anti-Marcos opposition. Gene had just returned from the Philippines, and Gene and Selmy had just returned from the International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union. There was some great progress made in both of those trips. And they were also talking about some of the work going on in the local community where they were fighting for the rights of the dispossessed and disenfranchised, particularly over housing issues, trying to maintain the character of the International District. So that was their meeting.
Now, what happens and where is Gene and where is Selmy and what do they see and what do they encounter?
Well, it was 4:20. They were, with the exception of Johnny Theodore, who was the janitor, they were the only two people in the Union Hall in the outer office. Gene had received a phone call from Ben Galloy because Ben wanted to know whether he could be dispatched to Alaska to work and was at a filing cabinet. Selmy was in the swivel chair in his desk, which was next to the file cabinet. So the two of them were within 3 or 4 feet of each other. So at that time, Jimmy Ramil had a brown paper bag. Ben Galloy enters the Union Hall first, which would kind of put Gene and Selmy off, because if Ramil had walked in, Selmy would have known something was up. So Ben comes in first. Ramil then comes in afterwards. Out of the brown paper bag, pulls out a MAC-10 45 caliber execution piece with a suppressor, points it at Gene, fires twice. Gene sees him, dies for the floor, and Gene is struck with two bullets tearing into his back and into his heart, killing him instantly. Ramil then swivels the gun toward Selmy, who's starting to get up from his chair, and puts four 45 caliber bullet holes in Selmy, believing him dead. Ramil and Galloy then exit the Union Hall, put the MAC-10 back into the paper bag, and walk down the alley, which is has walls on either side. At that time, Boy Pelai, the third hitman, then is the lookout. He then runs across the street, gets into a black Trans Am driven by Tony Dictato, and drive off. Now, we didn't know any of this at the time, but that's who the hit team was, four members of the Tulisan gang. Selmy, with unbelievable courage and bravery, gets out of his chair with four 45 caliber bullet holes in him, droplets of blood across the Union floor, goes out into the outside of the Union Hall and collapses on the sidewalk, screaming and yelling, you know, help me, help me. Believe it or not, there was a fire station a block away, and two first responders hear the cries of help. Someone said, hey, someone's been shot. So they went out, and Selmy was able to then, the firemen say, what happened? I've been shot. Who shot you? Ramil and Galoy. And so they write the names down, and one of them misspelled the name, said Ramo, R-A-M-M-O, and Selmy corrected him to R-A-M-I-L. So, boom, right then and there, Selmy was able to live long enough to name the two people that shot him. So then the fire trucks came and the medic came, and Selmy was hustled off to the Harborview Hospital in a vain attempt to save his life. And then if I could, if I could read from the, just a real quick passage from the book, here's what else happened. So it says, the ambulance roared off to Harborview Medical Center, sirens blaring. Across the street from the Union Hall, a middle-aged man in a gray suit and dark glasses emerged from a telephone booth, looked at the scene in front of the Union, and slipped into his car. As he pulled away from the curb, heading south on 2nd Avenue, he lifted a CB radio to his lips and started to speak. So what I do in the first, very first chapter of the book, introduced the fact that there was someone, we didn't know who it was at the time, across the street watching all this come down. Yeah. And I'll explain later how this person surfaced and how we found out who he was.
Yes, incredible. Now, obviously, Silme Domingo's partners, Terry Mast, and you talk about Bacon Hill, Seattle, and her first meeting Selmy in 1977. So talk about how they met and how they became partners and how much she was involved in this with Selmy.
Well, they met at an anti-martial law coalition, a meeting which the Union Democratic Filipinos were involved in. And Terry was drawn to Selmy's dynamism, his leadership abilities, his great organizing abilities. Selmy was drawn to Terry because she was patient, organized, level-headed, and it was a love match because the two of them just really got along well. I mean, like any couples, they went through, you know, some problems, but by the time of the International Longshore Warehousemen Union Convention in Hawaii that took place about a month before the murders, they had patched the relationship up. They had two beautiful little daughters, three-year-old Lagaya, and then Kalyan was just a few weeks shy of her first birthday, and those two girls were just the love of their lives. So Selmy and Terry were, you know, really living in a very happy situation at the time Selmy was cut down.
Now getting back to Selmy,
by the way, Terry was a union activist too. She was part of the reform movement within Local 37, a cannery worker in her own right, came from a strong working class background.
Now back to the hospital with Selmy, and you talk about the call for more blood, for people to donate blood. Tell us about what's happening at that scene, about the developing vigil that's there with friends and family, and tell us what,
yes,
how Terry is contacted and everyone's reaction. Tell us about this as you do in the book.
Well, my book draws the reaction of Terry Mast being told by her friends that Selmy's been shot, he's in the hospital, and Gina's dead, and she was just shell-shocked. And then Cindy Domingo, the sister of Selmy, was in Berkeley at the time, working for the National Union of Democratic Filipinos. And then I was up at El Centro de la Raza about to greet people, a summation of the march, when Michael Kozu, a Union of Democratic Filipino activist, took me aside and said, Gene's dead, Selmy's in the hospital. We need you to go to the Union Hall and find out what the police are doing. So after all of this happened, there was a vigil up at Harborview, and the word went out that Selmy's in dire needs, hundreds and hundreds of people came to the blood bank, and they were overflowing, and people just wanted to give their blood. That's how I get a little emotional still thinking about how many people responded. But more importantly, at the vigil, Selmy was in surgeries, and excuse me, his family was saying, well, wait a minute, where's Tony Barrusso? How come he's not here? So we basically had Adi Domingo, Selmy's mother, call up Tony and say, how come you're not down here? Oh, okay, well, I'll come down. So he comes down, and what he doesn't know but what we know, because I had been to the Union Hall and found out from the police that Selmy had named Ramil and Galloy. So we know that the police know that the names of the hitmen. So we confront Barrusso and say, okay, do you know the police know who shot him? And he kind of looks startled. Oh, no, who are those guys? And we said, well, you know, Jimmy Ramil and Ben Galloy. And there was this flicker in his eyes. Oh, I don't know those guys. And Nemesio Domingo Sr. said, of course you do. They're cannery workers. You go gamble with them down at the Union Hall. So the fact he denied knowing who Ramil and Galloy was significant to us. But then in addition, Selmy came too, and even though he's intubated, Terry and Adi were able to go up and talk to him, where they were able to confirm that, yes, Ramil and Galloy had been part of the, you know, had been the hitmen. But when Terry asked him, well, it was someone else, Selmy got agitated, nodding his head, and he took his right finger, index finger, like a gun, and pointing it to his leg. But Terry couldn't figure it out. He says, you've been shot in the leg? And he goes, no. And nobody could figure it out until later that evening we realized that Boy Pelai, the third hitman, had been shot earlier and had a limp, and Pelai means limp or someone who limps in Tagalog. So then we kind of put it together. So it was at that vigil before Selmy passed that we kind of came to the understanding that there was more involved than just Ramil and Galloy. And we immediately suspected Barrusso because the murder took place in his Union Hall, and he was close to at least, we knew, to Boy Pelai. So we started our investigation right then and there.
Now, we have to tell the audience about, again, Gene's trip to the Philippines and how close it was to this June 1st. And then we can talk about, again, the couple times that Gene and Silme, and these guys that were attached at the hip, addressed ILWU conventions.
Sure. Right. Well, as we're looking at this, you know, the head of the KDP, the Union of Democratic Filipino, Bruce Axenia, and another lieutenant, Dale Borgeson, who grew up in Seattle, we all got together with Cindy and Terry and the families and said, we got to figure this out. The first question is, are we going to go back in this Union Hall the next day? Because it was totally intimidating. And only when the police provided us with bulletproof vests and recommended we do target practice, you know, so we wore bulletproof vests for the first 6 months of this investigation and packed firearms because the Tulisan was still out there. But anyway, we started piecing this together and realizing, well, what? It didn't make sense to dispute over dispatch because 2 weeks after the murders, the Tulisan gang would have gotten most of their people up to the canneries. So the whole theory of the prosecution had a hole in it, and we started looking for deeper relationships. So to do that, we traced Gene's trip. Gene had always wanted to visit his family in the Philippines. His uncle Mariano lived there. His dad had passed away, Felix. But he went through the Bay Area and stopped at the Union Democratic Filipino headquarters, which at the time, the Naval Intelligence Investigative Service out of Alameda County Air Station had an informant within the Union of Democratic Filipinos pursuant to an executive order signed by President Gerald Ford. They were able to legally infiltrate a domestic organization. So Gene goes through the Bay Area and then goes to the Philippines. He's bringing with him $2,900 in monies to provide to the religious order there that was supporting the opposition, okay? So Gene went to the countryside to visit his family, but also visited the New People's Army in the countryside, kept a journal, and then toward the end of his journey, he went and met with the head of the May 1st movement, the large anti-Marcos union federation that had been outlawed under the Marcos regime. I mean, there were shootings at picket lines. Their leadership had been arrested and charged with sedition. They were really one of Marcos's biggest, the thorns in Marcos's side. Well, Gene was able to meet with the head of that union, Felixberto Olalla, who was later arrested and charged with subversion, Olalla was, and get from Olalla the conditions that faced Filipino workers, particularly in the export industry, where large U.S. multinationals operated and paid people very little without any union protections. So Gene then took this information and a letter from Felixberto Olalla to the International Longshore and Warehousemen's Union International Convention, which happened to be in Hawaii. And they were at the Sheraton Waikiki. Selmy joined Gene and a couple of the other KDP activists in Hawaii. And they engineered the passage of a resolution which for the first time put a mainstream U.S. union on record as concerned about Marcos's treatment of the labor. Even Cesar Chavez's United Farm Workers never took a position against Marcos. This wasn't so much a condemnation of Marcos as it was the key cutting-edge thing was to dispatch an investigative team to go to the Philippines and look into the poor conditions facing Filipino workers. Then, in the process of trying to get this passed, pro-Marcos elements within the large union in Hawaii, Local 142, took the floor to condemn the resolution, saying it lied about this and lied about that, and the conditions aren't so bad. And so they could tell that the local consul general, Trinidad Alcancel, of the Marcos government was involved in providing efforts to try to stop this resolution. Well, Gene and Selmy had done their homework, and they knew that once Local 142, the large Hawaiian local, came out in favor of the resolution, it was going to pass. So on the floor, Tony Barroso, who's the head of the delegation from Local 37, takes the floor and says, well, I support this resolution, and I've been on all these trade delegations of the Philippines, etc. So what Barroso did was basically realize it was going to pass anyway. He comes out and tries to pitch the international to appoint him as the head of the delegation rather than Gene and Selmy. It was a very shrewd move. But it also incurred the wrath of the Marcos regime because they were really upset this resolution passed. We believe later that we eventually realized there was Marcos military attaches that were in Hawaii that were monitoring all of this going on. Well, Gene took the floor, talked about his meeting with Felixberto Olalla. Selmy, the diplomat, was able to kind of, oh, well, we understand some people are upset about this, but believe me, this isn't a condemnation of Marcos. We just want to go to the Philippines and have a look-see and report back at the next convention. So the resolution passed because of the incredibly great political strategy and work that Gene and Selmy brought to bear. So then, believe it or not, that delegation never took place because within a month, both of them lied, were murdered by the Tulisan gang.
Now, how do police proceed with the information that they have that he has of sound mind and being able to say to these firemen, these are the people that killed me, even corrects the spelling? What do police do with that? How do they proceed with this information?
Well, what happened was the police work in the initial stage of the murders was incredibly great. John Boatman and Michael Tando worked this case tirelessly. What happened was they came to me and said, could you get us witnesses who could testify about the Tulisan gang? And we got them Angel Doniego. We got them a lot of witnesses who knew the inner workings of the Tulisan gang, but they had also had book on them. So what happened was they then get arrest warrants for Ramil and Galoy and arrest Ramil and Galoy, and that puts then pressure on the higher-ups, because people are afraid, well, what if Ramil and Galoy named Tony Decato, or they were willing to implicate Tony Barroso. So when Ramil and Galoy got arrested, Tony Barroso still comes into the union hall, and we have a big union meeting, and Terry Mass confronts him saying, you're not going to run this union anymore. You know, he was trying to take credit for some of the reforms that Gene and Selmy had brought about. and slapped her hand down on the desk. I, you know, when I saw that happen, I said, I'm going to follow that woman anywhere. Because here she is in Tony Bruce's union confronting him saying, we need a fair dispatch. Three people came forward to be the dispatch. We got bulletproof windows on the dispatch office, and nobody could dispatch other than these three. Well, Tony Bruce dispatched Boy Pilai up to Dillingham, Alaska, to Peter Pan, where the foreman of the Peter Pan cannery, a guy named Robert San Pablo, had heard about the murders about to happen. He didn't think it was going to happen, but he was internal to the murder conspiracy. So the police are interested in all of this. But what happened was Bruce is under a lot of pressure. Little did we know it, but what happened was Tony Dictato gets the MAC-10 murder weapon away from Ramil, and he plants it in a dumpster in West Seattle. And Rudy Schultz, who is a guy that likes to go work, you know, look through dumpsters, founds a murder weapon and gives it to the police. Well, guess who the murder weapon is registered to, Dan? Tony Bruce. So I get a call. From John Boatman in mid-July. This is like 5 weeks after the murder, saying, what's Tony Bruce's full name? I said, Constantine Bruce. And he goes, okay, that matches. I said, what do you got? He goes, sit tight, or I'll get back to you in a little bit. So what happens is they go do great police work. They go to Bruce's home. They said, we'd like you to come down to the station. Sure. He comes down to the station. And he's shown the MAC-10. They just pull it out of the bag and say, what's this? He goes, I've never seen that before. Well, then why is this gun registered to you? That gun there, I never saw it. It got stolen from me. I claimed it on my insurance. And the policeman said, well, who's your insurance agent? Lucho Singh. He's up in Capitol Hill. So, of course, they send the police up there, and Lucho Singh said, well, Tony Bruce did claim some weapons were stolen from his car, but he never claimed this weapon. So his alibi was broken in the first half an hour. So they arrest him. We go to the prosecuting attorney. He says, this is great. You got Bruce. There were some rumors that he had paid money to the Tulasan gang to get these murders happen. You got to arrest Tony Bruce. And Norm Mailing, the prosecuting attorney, and Joanne Maeda let Bruce out of jail. And we go crazy saying, how could you do that? His gun's a murder weapon. At any rate, they don't charge Bruce, and we're pretty upset with that. But in the meantime, the Ramil and Galloy trial is scheduled for September, and the Committee for Justice for Domingo and Varinas was formed. Elaine Coe and Bob Santos were co-chairs. I was heading up the legal team. I got my legal team together, John Coughlin, Jim Douglas, Liz Schott. That was the legal team that saw this case through for 10 years. And the Committee for Justice was so well organized. We had huge memorials for Gene and Selmy. We had a march through the International District turn anguish to anger. Thousands of people came forward. And we were a movement that was going to seek justice, no matter who it led to. So the hitmen trial is coming up. We are filling the courtrooms for the hearings. And then Selmy's dying declaration naming the hitman is admitted into evidence. So we're pretty convinced about a conviction for Ramil and Galloy. A witness had come forward, that's Jamie Malabu, who saw Ramil and Galloy walking down the alley, Ramil with a brown paper bag, getting into their car right at the time of the murders. So what happened, I'm going to tell you a story about this mystery witness, if that's okay now.
Sure, absolutely.
So the evidence is going in well. Joanne Maeda was doing a great job trying Ramil and Galloy. They had this lame-ass alibi that, they were gambling, dealing in the gambling halls in the International District. So they have a bunch of their gambling buddies come in saying, he was dealing for me. He wasn't shooting anybody. So nobody believed that. But then a mystery witness came forward, and Jim Grubb, who was the lawyer for Ramil, said, Your Honor, this guy just came forward to my office. He said he had seen pictures of the hitmen in the newspapers, and he was there. He was at the scene of the murders, and those weren't the guys that went into the Union Hall. And the prosecutor goes crazy, Your Honor, they haven't listed this witness. And the judge says, yeah, well, they didn't know about this witness. I'm going to allow them to testify, but I'm going to give you, Ms. Maeda, the opportunity to call this witness. So she talks to him over the weekend, and he comes forward, and the courtroom's totally packed. I was sitting next to Cindy, and this guy said, well, I'm a construction contractor in Alaska, and I just happened to be down in Pioneer Square, and I was trying to find the address of my architect, Alex Bertulius, and I try calling him up, but he's not in. And then I see this guy, one guy goes into this union hall, kind of this rinky-dink union hall across the street, and then he comes out really fast and gets into a green car and drives away, and then this guy comes out of the union hall hollering and yelling, and he collapses. And I said, oh, my God, this guy looks like he's been shot. So I run across the street. What happened? I've been shot. Who shot you? And the man said, I don't know. And Cindy's fingernails dug into my, I'll never forget this, into my leg, saying, what the? And so the guy said, I had a CB radio in my car, so I went over to my car and tried to get 911, but there wasn't any reception, so I drove around the block trying to get reception, and nobody was walking down the alley. So I drove up the alley, but there wasn't anybody there. And when I got there, I could see a fireman's helping. I didn't want to get involved. So I left and went back to my home in Port Orchard. Do you see the man that walked into the union hall with something under his arm? You see him in the courtroom? No, he's not there. Mr. Ramil, stand up, William. Mr. Forsythe, his name was. Levain Malvison Forsythe. Is this the man you saw walking? No, didn't look anything like him. So... Mr. Galloy, stand up. Was this the man who walked in there? No, didn't look anything like him. We're just sitting there saying, oh, my God, who is this guy? We have a Committee for Justice meeting that night, and we had the scenarios. One, Forsythe's a Martian. Two, he's a publicity seeker. Three, he's a paid witness.
Yeah.
Well, the prosecution used the fact that Forsythe actually had worked for Howard Hughes and knew – about this Mormon will, Melvin Dumar, if anybody's seen that movie, about the will that supposedly Howard Hughes had given to this guy Forsythe to deliver to Melvin Dumar in the desert. So it sounded like the guy was a total kook, right? That's the way the prosecution presented it, and they didn't believe him. Well, we ended up taking his deposition. The guy was an FBI informant. An informant for the FBI, and we only discovered, Dan, about 2 months ago, that the FBI in Seattle has 1,256 pages of documents related to this guy's work as an FBI informant for the Seattle office. In his deposition, he admitted being an FBI informant, admitted he knew Robert Mayhew out of the Howard Hughes empire, the guy that Kennedy administration used to contact the mafia to assassinate Fidel Castro. He was a deep U.S. Black bag job. He had done a lot of deliveries. And at any rate, we found all this out, but he never admitted he was an agent. He was operating out of Seattle. He said he was operating out of Southern California. So that's who this – so we had to look at it and say – okay, that means the FBI, someone in the FBI knew this was going to happen. I asked him, what was his modus operandi? What did you do for the FBI? I said, well, I'd be given a phone call. I would be told to go to a certain location, observe what happened, and write a report. I said, well, did you write a report on June 1st about the murders? He goes, yeah. Well, and he actually had a copy of the report. I said, well, who did you send it to? He said, I'm not trying real hard to remember. But he never admitted he was operated out of the Seattle FBI office. And we've now got a Freedom of Information Act request to the FBI to give us those documents, and they're stonewalling us. They're not giving us a single document. It's been almost 3 years.
Wow. Oh.
So that was our understanding then when we're looking at this guy coming forward that, there's very powerful interests that don't want Ramil and Galloy to get convicted. They don't want this to go up the chain and start, you know, looking at the higher levels, which by that time we suspected included the Marcos regime. And that, so we then, the prosecution brought a prosecution not only against Ramil and Galloy, but against Tony Dictato. In the meantime, Boy Pillai had absconded. He was gone. So they got Dictato convicted, and then we had to turn to our own civil lawsuit in order to get additional discovery, because it was clear to us that the prosecuting attorneys.
We were talking about Boy Pillai. What we didn't mention, though, is that, and he, you say he's on the run, but you also talk about Guloy being using Pillai as a as an alibi for June 1st, doesn't he?
Guloy used, well, it wasn't Pillai so much as he used, Guloy used other people that ran the gambling hall, a guy named Charlie Penor was the head of the, one of the gambling halls down there. So he called his the people who ran the gambling halls to say that Guloy was at the gambling hall, not at the union hall. But Pillai, he went to Alaska. Terry and I took Terry Mass and I took a visit to Alaska, and then Barroso decides he wants to come. But we were able to talk very briefly to Robert Sampabilo, and after that visit, Sampabilo then decides to turn state's evidence and talks to the Seattle Police Department that he overheard a conversation in which Dictato was saying, you know, we're going to kill Viernes. And that Boy Pillai told him that if he turned state evidence, he was going to kill him and blow up his car. I'm not sure in which order. So that made Sampabilo decide to seek protection from the police department, and he became a very key witness in the convictions of Ramil, Guloy, and Dictato, and we credit Robert Sampabilo with having, you know, uncovered and provided very valuable information. But Sampabilo also testified that Pillai told him they were to be paid $5,000 by Barroso for the hit.
Yeah, very, very, very incriminating. So how
does So Pillai's up to his eyeballs in this. It proves that Dictato and Barroso are up to their eyeballs in it, but they only charge Ramil Guloy and Dictato, not Pillai or Barroso at that time. And then Pillai absconds, and we don't hear from him for like a year.
You talked about the prosecution. It was evident that along this, what we haven't mentioned is, and to the audience, is that you have an incredible role in this as investigators. You're not a passive sitting at the phone waiting for news updates from police. You're actively interviewing witnesses, and later we'll talk about these incredible depositions. So when you are talking to the prosecutor, you are advising them what you think and trying to provide as much information to back up your assertions, aren't you? And you find with this that at some point the prosecution and you are not in agreement. Tell us about that.
Right. That's a really good question. And the lesson that we drew from it is that if you're involved in a justice efforts, you've got to use your own resources and not just rely upon the police and the prosecuting attorney to uncover the evidence. They play an incredible role. Boatman and Tando get my police hero of the years award for the work they did. On the other hand, the prosecuting attorney kind of blinked when it came to moving up the ladder to Tony Barroso. So what we did is, you know, we had Gene and Selmy were beloved in the community. So through Angel Boniego, Lynn Domingo, Selmy's sister, Cindy Domingo, through our contacts, Dave Dell and others, we put the word out through a call for justice that anybody with any information about this murder should come forward. And that's what got us to Jamie Malabo, because he was a kid. He was like 18 years old. He was really afraid. And his mother said, you got to go to the police. You got to go to the police. And Lynn Domingo encouraged him to go to the police, but he didn't want to go. But finally, he screwed his courage to the sticking post. And thank you, Jamie Malabo, for coming forward. And he came forward and testified. He saw Ramil and Guloy coming down the alley, very important witness. So we did provide the context and detail to the prosecution and witnesses. I mean, you know, all the members of the reform movement, Emily Van Bronckhorst, another true heroine in this saga, said that She saw Tony Dictato meeting with Barroso on the 30th of May, but right before the murders. So don't turn over to the prosecution attorney the pursuit of justice. But then we met a brick wall when it came to the higher-ups, and that's what frustrated us the most, both with, you know, with what happened to Boy Pillai sometime later, but also principally with Barroso. So I put together a 12-page memo. Here's the evidence against Barroso, and gave it to the prosecuting attorney, all the people who would testify. For instance, on the murder weapon, Barroso claimed he had never seen it, but Dave Della said that he had shown people that Mac 10 the Christmas before the murders, and Selmy, believe it or not, said to Dave, "Boy, I don't want to be on the other end of that piece."
Yeah.
So that was very vivid testimony. That would be something you don't forget, right? And so that we did everything we could to knock down Barroso's alibi, and it just they didn't charge him until way later. But then getting into the Boy Pillai story, is that okay now to talk a little bit about him?
Sure, absolutely.
Well, so we realized that they're not going to charge Barroso, but the key missing link of someone who knew Barroso's involvement in the murders was Boy Pillai. And so we're looking in the International District. He's gone. And someone said, well, his mom lives back in Maryland. Well, by this time, it's toward the fall of 1982. This is a year and a half after Ramil Galoy and Dictato were convicted. And we're looking at our civil suit. So we form a civil suit, a lawsuit against the Marcos dictatorship and U.S. involvement, U.S. government intelligence was involved in backing the Marcos regime. And our basic theory was that Marcos had sent his spies to the U.S. to monitor and operate against the U.S.-based anti-Marcos leadership, including the Union of Democratic Filipinos, including Gene and Selmy and others. You're not supposed to have spies. Military attachés attached to the consulate were identified. Well, we sue Marcos, and we get him served in Maryland. I mean, in D.C. at a national when he's here for a state visit with Ronald Reagan. We had an investigator who was a former Jesuit priest who had a collar, and so he's waiting for Marcos at the National Press Club, looking very, you know, obscure. And Marcos kind of walks, believe it or not, was walking down the hall, and he sees. Here's his father, just, you know, Catholic priest, and says, well, hello, father. And Bill Davis walks up to Marcos and says, here, I have something for you, and serves him with the papers. Well, we were celebrating. We had a big press conference. It was covered that we had served Marcos with the murders of U.S. citizens, even though by that time we had some evidence, but we didn't have as much as we eventually got. So I'm staying in Maryland, and believe it or not, I just said, you know what? Someone said Boy Pillai was in Maryland. I look up in the Maryland phone book, and in southern Maryland near D.C., Teo Dorico Dominguez. I look up the Dominguez name. There wasn't any Teo Doricos, but there was Dominguez. There was three of them. I call the first number and say, hi, is Boy Pillai there? And the woman at the end of the line says, oh, he just left. Who's calling? I couldn't believe my luck. It was a simple phone book, a simple phone call. We now know where Pillai is. Excuse me. So I call the prosecuting attorney, Joanne Maeda. I said, I found Pillai. What? Where are you? I'm in Maryland. So she takes 3 or 4 weeks, gets the Maryland State Patrol SWAT team to surround the house. A young man walks out of the house, gets in his car, and drives away. The SWAT team then raids it. Well, that was Pillai that walked out. And the excuse for not arresting him was, well, we didn't think he had a limp. We thought that Pillai had a limp, and we didn't want to have a shootout in the neighborhood in case. At any rate, so Pillai, then we lose him. Well, then about 3 months later, we hear that he's in the International District at the gambling halls again. So my investigator and I, Christopher Hershey, get a room in the Bush Hotel in the International District overlooking these gambling halls down, you know, from 6 floors up. We do a stakeout. And we see Pillai, and believe it or not, I took a picture of him from the Bush Hotel, and there he was in front of a car, later identified the next day as Tony Barroso's car. So I go to the prosecutor and said, we've got Pillai. Oh, okay, great. All right, well, we'll arrest him. You just stay off the streets. You're in danger down there. Well, I had my bulletproof vest. I was packing a .45. But I wasn't on the streets. I was up in the Bush Hotel, right? So then we heard we had an informant within the gambling halls. I'm not going to name that person, but the guy calls us and says, okay, you guys aren't going to believe this, but 2 6-foot-2 white guys in gray suits and thin ties walk into the 609 last night, the gambling hall, and ask, does anybody know where Boy Pelai is? We're looking for him. I go, you're kidding me. I said, this is horrible. So I called Joanne up and said, Joanne, did you send the FBI in there? Well, no, I didn't send it. Did you even tell the FBI? You could not have told the FBI about this, right? She goes, I have to. They're conducting an investigation. The FBI had entered the investigation of the murders back right after the murders, and they signed 42 FBI agents to interview all the union members, et cetera. They even had a witness, Dan, that they said Barroso met with the heads of the seafood industry after the murders, and he was laughing about how big the bullet holes were in Somi to these people. They had an inside witness, a guy named Clevenger. Anyway, so we were just outraged that the FBI had tipped off Pelai. We shut down the little search thing we had from the Bush Hotel, and then 2 weeks later we found out he's there again. So we set up our stakeout. We watch him. I see him down there, and I call. I don't call the prosecutor. I call John Boatman, the police department, the SPD. I said, "You want to cuff?" He says, "You want to get Pelai?" He says, "Yeah, I'll cuff Pelai." He says, "He's down on, you know, the sixth and lane in the ID." Boom. But within 5 minutes, there's 3 cop cars arresting Pelai. We go to the prosecutor and said, fantastic. Now you got Pelai. Turn Pelai. He'll testify against Barroso. Turn Barroso. He'll testify against the higher-ups. And I told Norm Mailing, I said, Norm, if you let Pelai out of jail, he's a dead man. Well, they held him for 72 hours and let him go. A month later, he's got 2 bullet holes in his head. Convicted of murder was a guy named Val Barbara, and the other guy that was implicated was a guy named Esteban Ablong, who had come from the Philippines with hundreds of dollars bills in his pocket and then left and flew back to the Philippines the next day. They tried – so the main murder – witness to the murders that could have implicated the higher-ups, Boy Pelai, was let out of jail, never charged, and then was found murdered. And we knew then and there that the cover-up had won a huge, huge victory, and that we had to turn our sights to our civil suit, where we had subpoena power, and started taking depositions and getting travel documents of Barroso, and started, you know, took Forsyth's deposition.
So the prosecution doesn't believe in political ties to these what you call assassinations, and isn't going to pursue it, and didn't pursue it, and so then you have to do this civil lawsuit to be able to, not number one, get information you wouldn't get otherwise, and also to be able to do things that you can't do in a criminal case. Explain what you want to do with this completely, with this civil action, and tell us what the process that you do next.
Yes. So we realized we'd run into a dead end at the prosecuting attorney's office. They weren't going to charge Barroso, and that was their choice. I mean, they control the criminal prosecution. We can only offer witnesses. So we created our own vehicle, which is a civil rights lawsuit brought under U.S. law that was basically passed back in, or right after the Civil War, that outlawed conspiracies in restraint of the exercise of First Amendment rights, okay? And it was used against the Klan. In fact, it was called the Ku Klux Klan Act. Well, we thought, what better use of this than against a murderous dictatorship of the Philippines? And so we brought the lawsuit against Ferdinand Marcos, the Republic of the Philippines, under the Foreign Sovereigns Immunity Act, and against the U.S. government for the fact that we had been told, just as a background, we had hired an investigator who had extensive ties in U.S. military intelligence, who informed us that the files in the Naval Investigative Service were starting to be disappearing. We should file Freedom of Information Act request. But he informed us that Naval Intelligence in the Bay Area had sent to both the FBI and to Marcos Intelligence a memo stating that Gene Vernis had come through the Bay Area and was traveling to the Philippines with $290,000 to provide to the anti-Marcos movement in the U.S. in the Philippines. Well, Gene didn't have $290,000; he had $2,900. Someone, maybe the informant or naval intelligence, had dropped a decimal point. Well, that obviously would have incurred, as we later found out when we took Marcos' deposition, incurred the intense interest of Marcos intelligence in the activities of Gene Vernis, both in the Philippines and in the U.S. So we thought that U.S. intelligence was complicit with the Marcos regime, and we proved it. But unfortunately, the first thing that happened in our civil suit is the U.S. government says, no, you can't sue Marcos. He's immunity. He's the head of state. And Marcos was dismissed from the lawsuit. They then brought a motion to dismiss the U.S. out of the case, and the judge, after 6 months, granted the motion. So the U.S. is gone. All we have is the Republic of the Philippines. The judge allowed us to amend our complaint to make it more specific, but meantime, there was appeals, and all we have is the ability to start taking some depositions. So what happened is we took Tony Barusa's deposition. Believe it or not, it was like 3 days before Pillay was rubbed out. We took Barusa's deposition, and we asked him, he took the Fifth Amendment on anything having to do with the murders, but he said, I said, well, after the ILWU convention, did you go anywhere? He says, no, I didn't go anywhere. I came back to Seattle. Well, did you have any occasion to have any income other than your job is at Boeing? He worked at Boeing and also at the union. No, I didn't have any other income. Well, what he didn't know is we had subpoenaed his travel records. And Dan, the day he got back to Seattle after the ILWU convention, he booked a flight down to San Francisco on the 16th of May to return on the 17th of May. And had stayed, according to his credit card, at a hotel within a few blocks of the Philippine consulate on Sutter in San Francisco. At the time, we had no idea what this was about. We just knew that he had taken this trip, and then he lied about it and denied it in his deposition. So it was kind of like, all right, you know, put this in a back burner for now. We took Forsythe's deposition, and we started taking depositions of some of the pro-Marcos people in Hawaii. Well, then the face of history occurred. And in August of 1983, in the middle when our lawsuit is still doing discovery, Benigno Aquino returns to the Philippines to run against Marcos. And he is on the airplane, and five gendarmes, when the plane lands, come on and haul him off, and he's gunned down before he even touches Philippine soil on the tarmac.
Wow.
And everybody, of course, suspects that Marcos and his military head, General Vare, were involved. So then that set in motion a chain of events that led to the People's Power Revolution, throwing a Marcos out of power in February of 1986. Our lawsuit's still barely alive, right?
Right.
But when Marcos is overthrown, we slapped a subpoena on him the day he got off Hickam Air Force Base and subpoenaed the U.S. Customs Services because he had brought with him thousands of pages of financial documents with him.
Oh, yeah.
Because he wanted to know where his billions were stored around the world in his secret bank accounts, because that's what he had done, is rip off the Filipino people. He got a percentage of every single contract ever cut in the Philippines for any work of any substantial nature of it. So we've looked through these documents, and it was interesting because in the bundle of documents, there was a two-page document that was a itemization of expenditures out of the Mabuhay Corporation, founded on July 7, 1977, 7777. Marcos's lucky number was 7. We knew this. And it turned out to have been, on the bottom it says, I acknowledge receiving $1 million from Philippine National Bank for intelligence purposes under the authority of General Vare, who is Marcos's henchman. And then it has an itemization of expenditures out of the slush fund, right?
Yeah.
Well, under special security projects on May 17th, the day Barusa had flown down to the Bay Area and came back the next day, there was an unexplained expenditure of $15,000 for a special security project.
Yeah.
We had taken we had taken Barrusso's bank records and, you know, went through them with a fine-tooth comb between right before the murders and the end of the summer in August. Barrusso, believe it or not, had deposited close to $10,000 in cash in his bank account. Go figure.
Yeah.
So he has $10,000 of cash deposited into his bank account and pays the hitmen $5,000. Bingo, $15,000. We now have the smoking gun because it, on its face, it said this is for intelligence purposes. They also had campaign contributions to Reagan and Carter and Dianne Feinstein, and all of this money that they had gotten from Marcos was operated out of this guy named Dr. Leonilo Malabed, who was a pro-Marcos doctor, ally in the Bay Area, who had tried to use the a radio station as a pro-Marcos vehicle, KJAS, but it was shut down. But this was a intelligence slush fund that he operated, and we then had this $15,000 payment. So as soon as we get these documents and realize we've got a smoking gun, we take Marcos's deposition, we take Malabed's deposition, and they all took the Fifth Amendment as it relates to the murders or any of their finances. But the beauty of it was that Marcos admitted that if someone like Gene had come to the Philippines to aid the anti-Marcos opposition, he would have been surveilled. And we proved that Marcos intelligence picked up the ILW resolution and, you know, was very upset about it. And our suspicion was that the consulate and Marcos had told Barrusso, get down to San Francisco, because there was a lieutenant colonel in the military whose name we still don't know, who came from the Philippines and met with Barrusso and the consulate general in San Francisco, and that's where the money changed hands. And so Barrusso then returns to Seattle and realizes that Dictato, the normal person he'd used to do something like this, was also pissed off at Viernes for not dispatching his boys, and so he concocts this murder conspiracy, which included the gang. He provides the gun as security and insurance for the murders, that he stood behind it, and he provides the money. And the only thing the two things they didn't count on was that Selmy would live and name the hitmen, and that Cindy Domingo and Terry Mast and we would form a committee for justice and fight on for decades, saying it's never over until all people that were responsible for this murder are brought to trial or are implicated. And what we did then was add Marcos back into the lawsuit because he was no longer the head of state. So Marcos was added as a defendant. Now we're going to try Ferdinand Marcos personally. We took a videotape perpetuation deposition of Marcos to play to the jury. Same with Imelda. And same with Dr. Malabed, who had just lame excuses. He had no excuse for what the $15,000 was for. He had no explanation for where this money went.
You talk about in the second deposition, which is important, and now that they're back in this and the climate in the entire nation and the world has changed, but you say that despite him taking the Fifth Amendment to be able to not answer questions, that you still did gain valuable information, as you say, from the questions he did answer. But you also talk about that there's a difference in the civil case versus a criminal case in how the jury views people taking the Fifth Amendment and not answering questions. Tell us about that.
Right. Well, the beauty of the strategy that we had, if I could be so immodest, was that Marcos, you know, he was happy to testify about how his intelligence agencies were thorough, they were dedicated. We had gotten him to admit that his intelligence agencies, including NISA, the National Intelligence Security Authority, headed by General Vare, had basically operatives in the U.S. We had received a Defense Intelligence Agency circular, which was basically leaked to us, which identified the two or five Marcos military attachés attached to the embassy. And they were described as here to monitor and possibly operate against the anti-Marcos movement. Well, we know what operate against means. That includes use of violence. So U.S. intelligence knew about it, but we used U.S. intelligence to prove what I call the Philippine infiltration plan. So with this conspiracy theory, all we had to do is prove that Marcos was initiated and part of the conspiracy to spy on and operate against his opposition in the United States, including Aquino, including members of the moderate opposition, and certainly including the Union of Democratic Filipinos. So we didn't have to prove that Marcos signed the death warrant for Gene and Selmy, just that he had this conspiracy and that the overt act of the conspiracy included murdering Benigno Aquino on the tarmac, included murdering Gene and Selmy in Seattle. So the beauty of the civil suit was when you take the Fifth Amendment, the jury can infer from the answers of taking the Fifth Amendment, the answers would be incriminatory. So we said to Marcos, we asked him, well, I never call him president. I said, Mr. Marcos, did the Mabuhay Corporation, was that used to pay for the assassinations of Gene Viernes and Selmy Domingo on June 1st? I'll take the Fifth Amendment. Well, that means the jury can conclude the answer was yes, it was. They don't have to conclude that, but they're entitled to conclude that. So in the criminal case, you can't comment on someone's taking the Fifth Amendment. You can't say, well, he must be guilty, he took the Fifth. In a civil suit, that's exactly what you can do. So that way we were able to get Marcos reinstated on the theory of this conspiracy theory, which was a live theory because it was proven by U.S. government documents. We even got documents from the State Department that were extraordinarily helpful. And I was fortunate because I went to Pomona College. My international relations mentor and college professor, Michael Armacost, left Pomona after I had graduated and became the third George Shultz's administration at the State Department under Ronald Reagan. He was in third in charge of the State Department and had been the U.S. ambassador to the Philippines. This is my friend, Michael Armacost. So yeah. I had gone and visited him saying, boy, we sure could use some documents from the State Department. And he told me, just keep pressing. And we ended up getting a dynamite document in which the ambassador of the Philippines, a U.S. ambassador of the Philippines, confronts Marcos about spies in the U.S. and saying, you can't send your spies here. This is under Carter, President Carter. And then saying, plus, you can't be funding, he said, Ilocanos with American wives. Now, Malabed was from Ilocos Norte, which is where Marcos was from. And it was also, by the way, where Tony Bruce was from, the Ilocanos. So Ilocano with American wives described Leonel Malabed. You can't be giving money to these people because it violates the Foreign Agents Registration Act. You can't give money for even media propaganda purposes. So the U.S. State Department confronted Marcos on both of the things which are central to our theory, both the Mabuhay Corporation as well as the Marcos spies in the U.S. So Armacost and a guy named James Knack from the State Department proved very useful for us in proving the case against Marcos. But we still needed, expert witnesses to tie all this together. So we had as expert witnesses a former Philippine military intelligence officer, Bonifacio Gallego, who knew the inner workings of the NISA and the Marcos spy operations, had done papers on it. He connected all the dots about Gene's travel to the Philippines was picked up, their work at the ILWU convention was transmitted to General Vare, and then the intelligence slush fund was used to pay for the murders. We had a former CIA agent, Ralph McGeehy, testify. We had Richard Falk, professor of international law, testify about the human rights violations of the Philippine dictatorship. So it was quite a trial, and it occurred in November of 1989. But about a month or in September before the trial, Marcos passed away. But fortunately, we had taken his deposition and were able to play his deposition at the trial.
What was it like for people to confront Ferdinand Marcos and see his wife as well and see them in a different light and under different circumstances?
Well, that would be a great question to ask Terry, because Terry Mass, I mean, here Terry was the widow of Selmy. They had launched a recall campaign, which was successful, to recall Tony Peruso, get him out of office. Okay? Because right. even if the prosecutor wasn't going to charge him, we're gonna get him out of office. So he was removed. Then in the Philippines, Cory Aquino, the wife and widow of Benigno Aquino, had removed Marcos from power. I mean, obviously, Terry on a much smaller scale, but still, Terry was very kind of really empowered, not only because of what she had done, which was tremendously courageous, but also what the People's Power Movement had done in the Philippines. So we're taking Marcos's deposition, and there's Terry confronting the man that had her husband killed, essentially, right?
Yeah.
And it was very tense. But then there came a time that the tension was broken because I was in the process of asking Marcos. I said, Mr. Marcos, could you tell the jury, because we had it on videotape, tell the jury why you declared martial law. And Marcos starts expounding, well, the communists were bombing the buildings. There was chaos in the streets. We had to... And I said, well, isn't it a fact that you were under the Philippine Constitution of 1936 that you were prevented from running for a third term in 1972 when you declared martial law? Oh, no, that's not true. And just then, we were on his estate on the shore in Oahu, a cockroach, a flying indestructible Hawaiian cockroach, flies in the room and lands on his shoulder. I didn't see it, and Marcos didn't see it because we're intent on the question and answer, but the cameraman saw the cockroach. He's going, what is that? So this cockroach is sitting there on his shoulder, and I said, are you sure about that? He goes, hold the phone, and the cockroach starts making a move toward Marcos's neck, and I call him the cockroach of truth. He's going to bite Marcos in the neck if Marcos doesn't tell the truth. Well, Richard Hybe, Marcos's lawyer, sees this cockroach, and he goes, boom, and he knocks the cockroach off Marcos's neck. And without missing a beat, Marcos looks at his lawyer and says, was that the wrong answer? And we played it for the jury, and the jury howled. Well, it just broke the tension when that happened. And from then on, you know, even though Marcos continually took the fifth, he gave us very valuable information about his spy agencies, his network of Marcos agents, the fact that if someone like Viernes had – he said if someone like Viernes had come to the Philippines doing what you said he did, his entire government would have spied on him. Well, we thought that was pretty helpful.
Now, you talk about that you don't know the outcome of this with the jury. You can only feel what sort of the mood that's coming from them. But then you have to also pitch – damages and explain why, what these damages are for and the reasons for those damages. So tell us about your summation in that regard.
Well, the summation, of course, has to start with the liability and proving that this dispute over dispatch theory was a cover for the deeper motives. But what we always wanted to return to was what we call the heart of the case. That's the last chapter on the trial in the book is the heart of the case, which was really about who Selmy and Gene were as human beings and as fighters for justice and democracy. But more than that, Selmy left two young daughters. And the heart of our case was Lagaya and Kalyan, because Terry was asking for no money for herself. It was all for her daughters. And so what we were able to do was say, well, what does it mean? How do we place a value, a monetary value, on what a parent brings to a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old daughter? That man that cooked the meals for her, that was the only one that could make her a birthday cake, Lagaya. The man who wouldn't be at her high school graduation, the presence in her life as she meets and starts dating boys or girls. So how do you place a value on what a parent's worth in our society? Well, what if you paid them minimum wage? Most people would say parents are worth more than minimum wage, particularly if you're a parent. I said, well, if you gave these kids damages for the minimum wage that people would have compensated Selmy for, then your verdict should be for $2 million for the lifetime of not having that parent for each of the child.
Yeah.
Well, it's a crude way of kind of putting a monetary value on what parents bring. But it wasn't because of the money. It was because of the character of how Terry and Cindy and the family described Selmy's relationship to his daughters. Gene was not married and didn't have kids, so he was unable to recover any substantial damages other than his future earnings minus what he would have spent, which is, you know, not very much. So that's how we presented damages. The defense in the case was the Seattle Police Department solved this murder 10 years ago. It was a dispute over dispatch for gambling in Alaska because these Tulisan gang wanted to gamble, run the gambling in Alaska, wanted to get their cut, and they weren't able to because Gene and Selmy had come up with this fair dispatch thing, and they were murdered because of that. Case closed. It's nothing to do with the Marcos regime. That's just playing upon your prejudices because Marcos has been overthrown. These were people who, quote-unquote, labored in smaller vineyards. Marcos would never have heard of them because they were so unimportant. So we had prepared for that defense and talked about how important that resolution was, made the headlines in the Philippines, and how important it was that Gene had met with the Union of Democratic, large May 1st movement in the Philippines.
How crucial was the information that you uncovered or the point that you could bring up that he brought $2,900 there for this organization, but yet someone said and someone thought it was $290,000, which makes a huge difference in terms of importance?
You know what? We proved our case without proving anything about the $290,000 because we tried to get those documents from the Naval Investigative Service, and we weren't able to. We got a lot of other great documents from Naval Investigative Services, including that they had a couple informants within the KDP at this time, that they had routinely sent their informants' reports to Marcos Intelligence and to the FBI. I mean, this was some very bad stuff that our intelligence. Why was U.S. intelligence taking the sides of Marcos in this situation? Well, they had a large naval base, Subic Bay, and it all relates to that. But no, we didn't have that document. So there was nothing about $290,000. Even though it was a crucial aspect of the motive that Marcos had, it wasn't admitted into evidence. But we used but then we even had better evidence, which was the intelligence slush fund used to pay for the murder. So that came in very handy. But, you know, what I said in my closing argument was made to look like a dispute over dispatch, but as his whole life passed before his eyes in the seconds after that burst of gunfire, Selmy Domingo had one thing in mind. There's one last thing I must do. My life must not be in vain. The principles and ideals I fought for were worth living for because Selmy said to themselves that the perpetrators of this foul crime must be brought to justice. That was his last wish, and we must answer it. That's what I implored the jury to do. But in that instance, when he said Ramil and Galoy, this murder plot began to unravel, not just for the hitmen, not just for Ramil and Galoy, not just for Pilay and Dictado, but those who put them up to it, for those who stood in the shadows, who covered their tracks. Because the tracks began to be uncovered, the gun was planted, fingers began to be pointed. But the other thing the perpetrators of this murder did not count on was the courage and tenacity of Terry Mast, Cindy Domingo, and Barbara Viernes, and their determination that justice would be done to get to the bottom of these murders. To me, that was the crucial argument where the jury said, we're with these women. And Linda Barber, who was the jury foreman, later told me that they were with them. They were with those women because of the courage that they had had to bring this case against one of the most powerful dictatorships in the world.
Now, you were successful. What was the damages? Any surprises?
Yeah. Well, we went out. Hybe gave a very strong closing argument. That was Marcos's lawyer about this had already been solved. But we also felt pretty good about the evidence we put in. So we waited. And you sweat a jury, and believe me, the word sweat is not a hyperbole. And we're there for about a day. And Hybe had broken camp and gone back to D.C., but he had a guy named John Coffey that was sitting in for him. And we got a word from the court. The judge wants to see us in chambers. You know, was there a verdict? No, no verdict. I go, oh, shit. What? The jury has a question. Well, you know, if you're a plaintiff's lawyer, Dan, and the jury has a question, you screwed up. They thought of something that you didn't think of, and you should have thought of it. It's your fault. And I went in there just with my chin on the floor. So I walk into the chambers, and, you know, there's John Coffey for Marcos and Kate Alfieri for Malibed. She was the lawyer for Malibed. And a little smile on Judge Rothstein, who was a fantastic federal trial judge, by the way. Smile on her face, and she goes, the jury has a question. I go, oh, my God, what is it? The question of the jury is, can we award more money than the plaintiff's lawyer has asked for in closing argument?
Yeah.
I just said, oh, my God, no. I mean, that, like, never happens. Because I had thought I'd asked for too much. Oh, yeah, sure, $4 million, yeah. And so then we knew we'd won. It was just a matter of how much the damages are. And so the judge says, well, I'm going to answer the question. Yes, read the instructions. You are the sole determination of damages. You can reward whatever you want. So after the jury verdict came in and there was just tumult in the courtroom, I mean, every single day the Committee for Justice, this is 8.5 years after the murders, Dan.
Yep.
The courtroom was actually packed with supporters and friends and family. Big cheers. The judge, how you see on TV, if there's one more outbreak, I'm going to clear this courtroom. The judge just let it go because there's this pent-up, you know, frustration, anger, excitement, and boom, it unleashed. And LaGaia runs up to counsel table. What happened? What happened? Did we win? You know, and Terry, yes, we won. And we talked to Linda Barber, the foreperson, after the jury. In fact, she came to the victory party. And she said, you know, the regret the jury had was we never got a chance to meet Gene and Selmy. But you brought them to life through your testimony. And the reason we did what we did was Mr. Withy said that if the average parent was worth, you know, minimum wage at the time, then you should award $2 million. But Selmy was not an average parent. He was far better than that. So they basically doubled what I asked for. And the final award from the jury was $15.1 million to the estates of Selmy Domingo and Gene Vernis. And then that was, at the time, the highest personal injury award in Washington state history. And it was the first and only time any foreign head of state had ever been held liable for the murder of U.S. citizens on U.S. soil, and it still is the only time this has ever happened. So it's a huge precedent in international human rights, and we, you know, it's all because of the work of the Committee for Justice for Domingo and Vernis and Terry Mastin, Sidney Domingo and Barbara Vernis, that this verdict came about. And it was only after that verdict came that we then went back to the prosecuting attorney's office and said, now you got to charge Brusso. And they did charge him with murder on our theory that Marcos had them killed, and he was convicted. Sentenced to life in prison, as was Dictato, Ramil, and Galloy. And Brusso died in prison, pretty much a lonely and broken man.
Yeah, we don't have time to get into it, but for those readers, you're going to see some incredible, very visual testimony from Dictato at the trials. And what he has to say when he is now in an unenviable position and situation.
Yeah.
Very, very interesting. Yes. I want to thank you very much, Michael Withy, for coming on and talking about summary execution, the Seattle assassinations of Selmy Domingo and Gene Vernis. Thank you very much. I want to know that this is a Wild Blue Press release. Tell us how people might contact you or find out about this work, Facebook page. Tell us about anything like that.
Yeah, great. To get the book comes out February 20th. You can go to my website, www.michaelwithy.com. Michael, the name, and Withy, Withey.com. You can also go to www.wildbluepress.com, all one word. You'll be able to get the book on, like I said, February 20th. I think we're about to be up and running in terms of pre-orders. But I'd love it if you read the book. It's an amazing story. We're having a launch, a commemoration of the lives and work of Jean Viernes and Selma Domingo on March 20th in Seattle. If you're in the Seattle area, come by the Labor Temple, 2800 First Avenue. We're going to have a lot of great speakers. Jeff Robinson from the ACLU, who tried the case with me, will speak. We have local politicians and people who supported our work speaking as well. So come on by.
Well, that's great. Congratulations on this and very, very important legal victory. And congratulations on this incredible story and bringing it to life and bringing all the major players and the memory of Selma Domingo and Jean Viernes. Definitely resonates with this book. I want to thank you very much for this interview.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Dan. That's who we wrote it for. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You have a great evening. Good night.
All right. Good night.